tip over when I tried to stand it on its side. The illegal stick proved to be the turning point of the series, as Montreal won the next three to clinch the Stanley Cup. Los Angeles failed to win another postseason game for the remainder of the 20th century, missing the playoffs in five of the next seven seasons. But the Kings finally snapped the streak, winning the Stanley Cup twice in 2012 and 2014, lifting any rumblings of a curse. Six seasons later, I caught up with McSorley after he signed with the Bruins in 1999. I told him I still had the stick he gave me back in 93, and he simply smiled. "That's great to hear," McSorley said. "So many times I give stuff out to people only to see it for sale somewhere. Turns out he didn't think I was a Canadian spy after all." My stick collecting days came to an end around 1995 after I joined the sports media ranks full time, but they've left a lasting impression. Today, McSorley's stick stands prominently in the corner of my office next to Cullen's black Sherwood 7030 I got in 1985, and while it may be a little dusty and the snap wax melted, it's still the ultimate Stanley Cup souvenir and a true testament of what my hockey stick-to-itiveness. And nothing can ever take that away from me. Christopher Hurley is a hockey stick connoisseur and a multimedia sports journalist with the Lowell Sun. So
that's good.
That's a memento he's never going to give up.
No, that certainly is. Now, we want to say it's still sunny out, so if you get a chance, go for a walk. And Dorothy and I are saying, have a good day. City committed to innovation for community, for the good of our people and the good of the public. We know that in the years ahead, the regional life sciences industry will need thousands of new workers, and they continue to grow right here in Boston. And as the world's leading life sciences hub, Boston must be prepared to meet that demand by drawing on the talent that lives right here in our city today, end quote. Standing alongside life science leaders in the Boston Convention and Exhibition Center, Wu said the initial grant application round will seek proposals from organizations that are prepared to provide industry-aligned training and education programs to connect city residents to, quote, good-paying life sciences jobs and career pathways, end quote. The city is particularly interested in applicants with programs that include internships and hiring commitments at life sciences companies, Wu said. Further, these organizations should offer training opportunities for in-demand positions within this sector, which ranges from research and development to manufacturing products and services that rely on fundamental knowledge of biology, biochemistry, and related science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, or STEM subjects. They should seek to empower residents without four-year degrees, particularly workers of color, women, and immigrants, quote, all of whom are underrepresented in the industry today and ready and eager from our communities to contribute, end quote, said Wu. The grant, which includes a combination of funds from the Federal American Rescue Plan Act and the city's Neighborhood Jobs Trust, will also establish an intermediary organization that will provide additional support to workers, training providers, and employers. This support will be aimed at helping the relative parties combat daily challenges like childcare and transportation to ensure that this inclusive pathway becomes a permanent fixture in the industry, Wu said. To combat the phenomenon of residents feeling, quote, deeply disconnected, end quote, from the rapidly growing life sciences sector in their own backyard, Wu said the new initiative will also involve a public awareness campaign to alert the community of potential career opportunities. The American City Coalition, Lab Central Ignite, and the Massachusetts Biotechnology Education Foundation are the funded partners for this campaign. Massachusetts Secretary of Labor and Workforce Development, Lauren Jones, spoke of how the new initiative, part of the city-state partnership that aims to ensure job opportunities in the life sciences sector, will expand opportunities, quote, to prepare our untapped diverse talent. This significant growth happening right here for the life sciences industry is in the city of Boston and needs to connect to the city of Boston, Jones said. We cannot afford to leave anyone behind as the city grows and workforce needs remain in high demand, end quote. The new initiative has the support of the Healy Driscoll administration, she added, describing it as a win-win for all those involved. Jones said, quote, we're investing in the success of Boston residents and also our workforce, and certainly supporting the needs of local employers. We are unlocking assets that are right here in our backyard, end quote. Gael Akaliza, a coordinator in quality assurance at Vertex Pharmaceuticals, one of the state's largest biotech employers, said her career was made possible through a similar workforce development program called Year Up. The first 6 months of training through this program, which describes itself as providing equitable access to economic opportunity and education for all young adults, regardless of their background or zip code, was, quote, intensive, end quote, Akaliza said. The technology certifications, along with the business and communications skills she acquired through this initial training period, led to an internship at Vertex, Akaliza said. She later landed a position at the company and is now pursuing a degree in healthcare management and communication, she said, and went on, quote, I joined Vertex because I wanted to help people. I think that all these programs are here to help young people like me, and I think if we're providing opportunities and providing tools and resources to equip young adults like me, we're creating a better future for all of us. And that was Gayla Colley writing today. Claire?
Thanks, Mary Ellen. I will read an article under Charlestown entitled DNA Key Clue in Cold Case, and subheaded, New Jersey Lawyer Alleged Serial Rapist, Fiancé Attends Arraignment. This is written by Grace Zunkovich. a New Jersey lawyer arrested for a series of cold case rapes and assaults in Boston in 2007 and 2008, was targeted by a DNA sample collected from a glass and utensils at a corporate event, prosecutors said at the suspect's arraignment yesterday. Matthew Nilo, 35, pleaded not guilty to charges related to the alleged assaults and was ordered held on a $500,000 cash bail. He was supported in the Suffolk Superior Courtroom by his fiancée, Laura Griffin. Nilo, a North End native, is charged with 3 counts of aggravated rape, 2 counts of kidnapping, 1 count of assault with intent to rape, and 1 count of indecent assault and battery. The charges stem from alleged attacks in the Terminal Street area of Charlestown on August 18, 2007, November 22, 2007, August 5, 2008, and December 23, 2008, which prosecutors outlined in brutal detail. The first 2 victims, both 23 years old at the time of the separate alleged rapes, reported being out at a bar and high school reunion on State Street when they accepted a ride from a man under false pretenses. Both reported being driven to a location around Terminal Street, threatened with weapons, ordered out of the car, and forcibly raped, prosecutors detailed. The third victim, a 36-year-old woman, said she was panhandling in the Boston Common when a young man bribed her to get into his car, prosecutors said. When they got to Terminal Street and exited the vehicle, the man allegedly tackled her, held a gun to her back, and raped her. In the last incident, prosecutors said, a 44-year-old woman was jogging near Terminal Street when a man allegedly jumped and assaulted her. Though he repeatedly claimed to have a gun, the woman reported, she fought him off, poking him in the eyes with a gloved hand. DNA evidence was collected from 3 rape kits from the first 3 victims and the fourth victim's glove. The first 3 cases were linked to 1 genetic profile during the initial investigations, but no suspect was identified, prosecutors said. In 2022, Boston police revisited the unsolved cases, according to Suffolk District Attorney Lynn Feigenbaum, using newer, quote, forensic investigative genetic genealogy tools. Investigators identified Nilo as a person of interest by comparing the DNA samples to genetic information on genealogy databases that users have opted to make public. FBI agents tailed Nilo in New Jersey and New York, where he worked for a law firm, following him to a corporate event where they obtained utensils and a drinking glass allegedly used by him. Boston police were able to match the DNA recovered from the drinking glass to the 3 rape kit samples, Feigenbaum said, and determined the glove sample was, quote, 314 times more likely to belong to Matthew Nilo than any other male in the population. The defendant's lawyer, Joseph Cataldo, said he is withholding comment on the allegations until fully reviewing the case, but his client, quote, denies the allegations, unquote. However, Cataldo said, the public record suggests there may have been some, quote, questionable procedures utilized by law enforcement, unquote, regarding whether there was a timely search warrant for the DNA taken from the corporate event. Quote, if it is true that they didn't obtain a search warrant prior to obtaining his DNA, then that is something we will vigorously challenge in court system as an unconstitutional search, Cataldo said. Nilo was arrested last Tuesday at his home in Weehawken, New Jersey, and agreed to waive extradition during a court appearance there last week. In addition to bail, Clerk Magistrate Edward Curley ordered Nilo to wear a GPS tracker if released, surrender his passport, have no contact with the victims, and stay 1,000 feet away from Terminal Street in Charlestown unless accompanied by his attorney. Nilo is due back in court at 9 a.m. Monday. Mary Ellen.
Under the subsection 2024 election, Joe Battenfeld is writing his column, Live Free or Bow Out. Sununu's exit from the presidential field is underwhelming. New Hampshire Governor Chris Sununu's predictable withdrawal from the 2024 presidential field landed with a thud. The latest contribution from milquetoast Northeast Republicans. To say Sununu's announcement landed with a thud is even giving it too much impact. Almost no one thought he was really going to run anyway. Well, maybe CNN bid on it. It comes the same day former Vice President Mike Pence announces his White House bid, and the day before former New Jersey Governor Chris Christie and North Dakota Governor Doug Burgum wades into the 2024 battle. That's right, Burgum. Sununu said he decided not to run because he didn't want to expand the crowded field anymore, making it easier for Donald Trump to win the nomination. He tweeted, quote, the stakes are too high for a crowded field to hand the nomination to a candidate who earns just 35% of the vote, and I will help to ensure this does not happen, end quote. Sununu also got on his favorite network to scold Republicans who are in the race, saying they should get out if they can't win. He said on CNN, quote, there are 12 people in the race. I don't think all 12 of them firmly believe that they can be president. I think a lot of them just want to audition to be in the cabinet or vice president. And at this time, there's no place for that, end quote. But the reality is you can include Sununu on that list. He was dead last in the polls, even in his home state, and could not compete against Trump or even Florida Governor Ron DeSantis. His brief flirtation with a White House run was somewhat embarrassing, although it did give him a platform on liberal networks. Sununu is such a political lightweight, he makes Mitt Romney seem like a heavyweight. Sununu, who also turned down a U.S. Senate bid last year, said he plans to stay involved in the race by endorsing someone. No thanks, Chris. Who wants that kiss of death? Let's not forget where Sununu comes from. His father, former White House Chief of Staff John Sununu, was forced out partly because of the Travelgate scandal, taking more than 70 rides on military jets for personal use like ski trips and visits to the dentist. So his constant dumping on Trump for ethical problems sounds a little hollow. Sununu said of Trump in an op-ed in the Washington Post, quote, if he is the nominee, Republicans will lose again, just as we did in 2018, 2020, and 2022, end quote. Sununu, of course, leaves out 2016 when Trump won the White House for Republicans. Sununu is relatively popular in the Granite State and likely could win another term as governor. Or maybe he's holding out for an upset defeat of Trump so he can latch on with another rhino candidate. While he was flirting with a run, Sununu was trying to walk a fine line of being a Romney-esque Republican and calling himself conservative. Sununu is more in the mold of former Massachusetts Governor Charlie Baker and Senator Mitt Romney, all former or current Bay State governors, none of them profiles in courage. Last time we heard from Romney, he was feuding with George Santos. Are these weak Northeast governors supposed to represent the new Republican Party? If so, you can count on Democrats controlling the states for decades to come. And that was Joe Battenfeld writing today in the Boston Herald. Clear?
Okay, Mary Ellen. Under Beacon Hill, the headline is State Tax Break Not Dead Yet. $2.5 billion error won't eat away plan, says Spilka. This is written by Matthew Metzger. Despite the obvious similarities, there will not be a repeat of last year's failed effort to provide tax relief, the state Senate president said Monday when asked if reports that Massachusetts owes billions to the feds might somehow mirror last year's unexpected $3 billion tax rebate requirement. State Senate President Karen Spilka, speaking to reporters after meeting with both Governor Maura Healey and House Speaker Ron Mariano for one of the trio's somewhat regular, quote, leadership meetings, said last summer's sudden shelving of a unanimously accepted economic development bill, brought about after lawmakers learned they had taken too much from taxpayers and would need to send billions back under a rarely invoked 1986 law, will not serve as a precedent for a second slow walk on tax relief. Quote, we are proceeding with a tax relief package. As I've said for many months, we will do a tax relief package, she said. On Friday, a yearly audit revealed Baker administration officials apparently used $2.5 billion in federal pandemic era relief funds to cover the cost of state-provided unemployment benefits, a tab which is supposed to be picked up by the Commonwealth, not the feds. It is unclear when the federal government will be paid back or how the error was made. On Monday, lawmakers said they were still in a fact-finding phase. The state's Executive Office of Labor and Workforce Development said the discrepancy occurred in 2020 and was, quote, only recently identified, unquote, by the Healey administration. According to the Senate president, despite that unexpected unemployment bill arriving, which she contends isn't even necessarily reflective of what the state may owe back, the upper chamber will proceed with the sort of progressive tax cuts she has been championing all session. The Senate's about $56 billion fiscal 2024 budget, unanimously passed at the end of May, already includes a carve-out for $575 million in tax relief. That's about what was approved last year but abandoned, and yet still hundreds of millions less than the economic reform plans offered by the State House and Governor. What will be in the plan is still up in the air. Senate Ways and Means Chair Michael Rodriguez said a bill would be released in the, quote, next 2 weeks. He said, we are in regular communication with our colleagues, putting together a package as we speak, he told the State House News Service. According to Spilka, residents will learn the specifics of the Senate's tax cut plan soon, quote unquote. So, stay tuned, she said. And that's the end of that article. Moving on.
Thank you. Matthew Metzger is writing a companion piece to that $2.5 billion puzzle. Headlines, $2.5 billion bill is still a puzzle for the state. The state's leaders are still not precisely sure how Massachusetts came to spend the wrong money on pandemic-era unemployment benefits, or even how much, but you can bet the erroneously spent dollars were a topic of discussion. Beacon Hill was abuzz last week after a routine audit revealed that the Baker administration, in the middle of his second term, apparently spent $2.5 billion in federal funds on unemployment insurance payouts that were supposed to be covered by Massachusetts tax dollars. Governor Maura Healey was the Attorney General when that money was spent, so it would be incorrect to imply there is blame to lay at her feet for the error. Nevertheless, the state's current chief executive was immediately asked to answer for the apparent misplacement of billions in COVID funds
after she left an afternoon meeting with the House Speaker and Senate President. Healy said alongside Speaker Ron Mariano and Senate President Karen Spilka, quote, "This is something that we became aware of very, very recently," end quote. According to Healy, while it's clear that during the pandemic there were federal funds coming into the state from various pots following the passage of several different pandemic response bills, it is not clear how money was drawn from the wrong account or when it will need to be returned. She said, quote, "What happened is that there were multiple funds set up, as you know, during this COVID pandemic time. And for whatever reason, money was drawn from a federal pot instead of a state pot. Our plan has been to continue discussion with the U.S. Department of Labor on this and to hopefully be able to resolve things in a way that minimizes any impact to the Commonwealth." End quote. And Spilka chimed in, quote, "We're sort of in a fact-finding stage right now. I think it's too early to speculate what action we would be taking," end quote. And Mariano added, "We don't even know how much we owe." The audit showed that in 2020 and through the pandemic, the state Labor Department withdrew federal relief funds for unemployment claims that should have been covered by the state's unemployment trust fund, which Massachusetts employers pay into, according to labor officials. Healy said, quote, "In broad strokes, it was money that was really set aside as a federal account, a federal bucket, and we had a state bucket. At some point, these two got merged, and money was unfortunately drawn down from this federal account," end quote. A U.S. Department of Labor spokesperson confirmed they have been in discussion with state officials about the oversight and are working with the state on options to rectify the situation. And that was Matthew Metzger writing. Clear?
Okay. Now, under the headline drone study, it reads, cue the, quote, Jaws theme music. Great white sharks lurked near swimmers and surfers 97% of the time. This is written by Rick Sobey. As great white sharks make their way back north to Cape Cod for the summer and fall, shark researchers have released shocking results from a two-year drone study showing that apex predators came very close to people, but simply moved around them or ignored them completely. The study along Southern California beaches looked at how close juvenile white sharks get to humans, such as waders, swimmers, surfers, and stand-up paddleboarders. The researchers from Cal State Long Beach Shark Lab revealed that at juvenile white shark aggregation sites, people were near sharks on 97% of the days surveyed. And during the two-year drone study, there were no reported shark bites in any of the surveyed locations. Christopher Lowe, professor of marine biology and director of CSULB Shark Lab, told the Herald on Monday, quote, "Frankly, we were shocked. Sharks would interact with people every single day, multiple times a day, and they would just swim by. It was shocking that these occurrences were happening so often," he added, "and the fact that no one was being bitten smacks in the face of misconception that if there's a white shark nearby, you'll be attacked. This shows that's not the case," unquote. More than 1,500 drone surveys were conducted from 2019 through 2021 across 26 different Southern California beaches to measure human juvenile white shark habitat overlap. The juvenile white sharks were often spotted within 50 yards of where the waves break, putting surfers and stand-up paddleboarders in the closest proximity to sharks. Some sharks were seen as close as 2 yards from the wave break. There were a number of times when white sharks would swim by people, and the people just didn't know it, Lowe said. He went on, the swimmers could not see them, and it happens far more than people imagine. Lowe grew up on Martha's Vineyard, and when it was very rare to see a great white shark, and when the gray seal population had not exploded along the Cape. He compared the California shark situation to the Cape shark situation, noting that researchers have been starting to see more and more sharks popping up along Southern California beaches in the last 20 years. One major difference is Cape seals have claimed territory at beaches, bringing adult white sharks closer to people. Quote, that makes a very different situation, but there's still people going in the water, and white sharks are still swimming by people on the Cape, and they aren't being bitten, Lowe said. And he added, there are a lot of opportunities to use drones along the Cape, and I think people will be surprised with what they see. This method of surveillance using drone videography can also be used for future approaches for research, education, or overall beach safety purposes. These findings are applicable on a global scale, providing confirmation of sharks and humans peacefully coinciding in the same location. Lowe said, I hope the state of Massachusetts does what California does and invests more in research. I think that will really help. End quote. And end of article. Mary Ellen?
Oh, thanks, Claire. At just about 30 minutes past the hour, shall we turn to the Herald opinion pages?
Certainly.
We have four articles here today. An editorial and three op-eds. I'm going to read the editorial and the first op-ed. The editorial is entitled, Sununu is an example for GOP Trump opponents. The GOP owes New Hampshire Governor Chris Sununu a note of thanks for his wise decision in the run-up to the 2024 presidential election. He decided not to run. It's not that he doesn't have the goods. Sununu remains popular in New Hampshire because he's a sharp, concise thinker who gets things done. He has a 61% job approval rating and just won re-election to a fourth term. In a contest not overshadowed by Donald Trump and Joe Biden, he'd be a standout. But 2024 is all about the rematch, and it's a smart politician who knows not to waste his energy, time, money, and the voters' patience. Remember the full-on scrum that was the Democratic candidate lineup in 2020? The debate stage looked like a chorus line until one by one the hopefuls dropped out. Whether it was lack of fun,
good morning. You're listening to Lowell Association for the Blind's Lab Radio. Lab Radio is a member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. Lab, your main source of accessible community news and information, located in Lowell, Massachusetts. We read local news, editorials, feature stories, and more. Lab Radio is brought to you by volunteers and staff of the Lowell Association for the Blind. This is Michaela, and I will be reading from today's edition of the Lowell Sun, which is Tuesday, June 6th, 2023. We're going to start things off with the first headline today, and that comes out of Centralville. The headline reads, Two-alarm fire displaces 12. Lowell. Fire crews battled a two-alarm fire on West 6th Street Monday afternoon that left 12 people displaced from a residential apartment building. Lowell Deputy Fire Chief Tim Casey said at the scene that the fire was called in at 1:18 p.m. after smoke and flames were seen coming out of a first-floor window of the building and climbing up the side. The flames were extinguished by 2 p.m. No injuries were reported among residents or firefighters. Casey said that when firefighters responded, they had been told of a possible trapped person in the building, but that nobody was located during the search after the fire was extinguished. The cause of the fire has not been officially determined and is still under investigation, Casey says. Though the official investigation into the cause of the blaze is ongoing, Sol Marie Rodriguez, who lives in the first floor apartment where the fire started, suggested that it was... Turning to page 5. Suggested that it was a result of the faulty stove. Rodriguez said at that time that they also had a cat that they were unable to get out of the house and were waiting for firefighters to find it. After about an hour, a firefighter exited the building with Azrael, the cat, in his hands, scared, covered in soot, but very much alive and reunited with his owners after having hid somewhere in the house. Nearby resident Nick Park said he was across the street from the house when he heard someone yelling that there was a fire, and he then observed smoke coming from the first floor window. Another nearby resident had called 911, but when the response took some time, Park said he ran to get the attention of firefighters at the station, just a few buildings down on West 6th Street, who themselves responded to the scene. Linda Silva said she was in her car on the corner of West 6th and Boisvert Streets when she saw the flames in her rearview mirror. After 911 was called, she said she went to give extra clothes to one of the building's now displaced residents. Now, although this isn't an actual article and is more pictures, I do want to mention this because it is just an amazing achievement that should always be recognized every year. And I am talking about graduation. This headline reads, "Entering the Next Era, Chelmsford High Class of 2023 Passes the Gavel." The first picture is a big picture, and then there's two smaller pictures underneath, and it shows a graduate shaking some hands and what I assume to be getting something for graduation. He is on stage, and he is in front of all of the faculty and staff that are sitting up there on the graduation stage. And there are two, the students are in purple robes. Some people have other regalia, such as honors cords or stoles. And then the faculty members are wearing the color, the robes and colors and regalia that they graduated college in. There are two banners hanging that says Chelmsford High School in red and white, and the banner also has the school's insignia on it, which appears to be a lion with an outline. The caption of this picture reads, "Chelmsford High School Class of 2023 President Martin Coleman passes the gavel to Class of 2024 President Rowan Medhukarmar at the Sangha Center in Lowell on June 3, 2023. Coleman is also the salutatorian for the Class of 2023. There's another picture in the bottom left. It shows a female student, female presenting student, waving to the crowd. There is another female presenting student behind her smiling, and two male presenting students behind them, all in line to graduate. The photo reads, "A graduate waves to friends and family in the stands." And then the last picture in this mini article is on the bottom right, and it shows the back of the heads of the graduates and how some people graduated their cap. This student in particular decorated it with a blue background to represent the ocean with a wave and some type of fish. It looks almost like a goldfish on top of a seahorse, and it says limitless potential on it. And the caption of that picture reads, many of the students wore uniquely decorated mortar boards. Alright, so the next article is from the zoning board, and it says, how far is too far with housing? Vacant lot on Gibson Street, a microcosm of housing crisis. This article comes out of Lowell. Mary Burns' family has owned the vacant lot located at 209 Gibson Street since 1962. Where the neighbors see an eyesore, with the 4,000 square foot lot overgrown with trees and vines and strewn with trash, Burns sees a buildable lot that could be the new home to a family. Burns wants to construct a 1,700 square foot, 3-bedroom, 2-bathroom house, but the size of the lot compared to the dimensions of the proposed project requires approval from the City Zoning Board of Appeals. We're going to turn to page 5 again to continue this article. Several neighbors, 24 of whom signed a petition, in opposition to the site plan, showed up to speak at the May 22nd public hearing of the board. A butter, Clinton Roche, said his property shares a property line with the vacant lot, and he told the board that building a house that size on a lot so close to his home is pretty ridiculous to me. There's no room, said Moshe, who added that the lot hasn't been maintained in 20 years. He cited the architectural rendering that showed a building that would be between 6 to 7 feet away from the entire length of his home, claiming the roof overhang would bring the distance down to 6 feet at height. I don't see how we can build a house this close to mine, Moshe said. It's just too close. I just don't think it's right. Like many communities in the Commonwealth, Lowell has a housing crisis. At a May ceremony announcing $246 million to build and preserve 1,600 affordable and mixed-income housing units in 20 communities across the state, including Lowell, Lieutenant Governor Kim Driscoll said the state is short 200,000 housing units. The impact of high housing costs, combined with low housing stock, has hit residents looking for low-income and affordable housing the hardest. The Lowell City Council is currently mulling approval of an accessory dwelling unit ordinance to help address the housing need. ADUs allow homeowners to build small rental units within or on their property by right. The by-right language means that if these ADU applicants meet the building code criteria and obtain the required permits, they can bypass the land use or zoning board process. Attorney John Geary, who represented Burns before the zoning board, said Burns' proposed house is consistent with the city's master plan and 2025 housing choice plan. It provides an additional house in the city, which is great. It ultimately will create a reasonably priced home for a family to live in this beautiful neighborhood. Concerns about increased neighborhood congestion and how the house would alter the character of the neighborhood were raised by Gibson Street resident Fred Bowell. The property sits within the Tyler Park Historic District, a neighborhood that was listed on the National Register of Historic Places in 1989 and includes more than 400 houses. If we're going to begin to build these homes on a 4,000 square foot lot, what we're doing is we're taking away from the historical aspect of the neighborhood in the Tyler Park Historic District, Bahu said. We have a board. We have events. Everyone loves being a part of this district. Geary said the site plan addresses neighbor concerns. Since our initial filing, which was quite some time ago now, we've revised all of our plans, Geary said. It's a complete new design of the proposed home. The revised design no longer proposes a garage. It also takes into consideration some of the comments from the historic board administrator in terms of siding and windows. Excuse me. Homes in the TPHD must go before the Low Historic Board before work begins and any other city permits and approvals are issued. Because the house is almost half the size of the lot, the variances Burns is requesting from the zoning board include relief from bare lot area, from minimum lot area, minimum lot size, minimum side yard setback, lot area per dwelling area, and floor area ratio requirements, and any other relief required under the Low Zoning Ordinance. The petition also asks relief for the driveway setbacks. The number of and kind of requests was too much for board member Dennis McCarthy, who also chided Geary for making the argument that a building would be better for the neighborhood than looking at a neglected lot that the applicant already owns. You're asking for 7 variances, McCarthy said. That's a tremendous amount of variances. It seems rather excessive. I'm disappointed that the applicant doesn't maintain the lot in the neighborhood that she lives in and is asking us for 3 variances more than she has to. It seems like a lack of care and concern for the neighborhood. He noted that if Burns built a more modest home, she could eliminate at least 3 variances from her petition. That thought was expanded on by Chair Van Peck, who asked Geary if his client would be open to scaling down the size of the project. Go back to the drawing board, Petch said. How it stands now isn't doing anyone any favors or justice. You are seeking a lot of relief. If you go back to the drawing board, maybe there's only a few variances you need, or maybe none. After consultation with Burns, who was present but did not speak, Geary said that Burns would try to alleviate some of the relief that we're requesting tonight. With no objections, the board voted to continue the variance hearing on the Gibson Street application until June 26th. In response to neighborhood concerns about the Gibson Street development, Councillor Eric Gitchier's motion requesting the city manager have the city solicitor provide the council with a report outlining how a resident can appeal a zoning board decision with the estimated cost to the resident unanimously passed at the city council's May 30th meeting. The next meeting of the council on regular business is June 13th, at which the motion response could be discussed. Next, we have some shorter articles for you folks. This comes out of the IOU column. $2.5 billion bill, still a puzzle for state. The state's leaders are still not precisely sure how Massachusetts came to spend the wrong money on pandemic-era unemployment benefits, or even how much. But you can bet the erroneously spent dollars were a topic of discussion. Beacon Hill was abuzz last week after a routine audit revealed that the Baker administration, in the middle of a second term, apparently spent $2.5 billion in federal funds on unemployment insurance payouts that were supposed to be covered by Massachusetts tax dollars. Governor Maura Healey was the Attorney General when that money was spent, so it would be incorrect to imply that there is blame to lay at her feet for the error. Excuse me, my Boston accent is coming through. Nevertheless, the state's current chief executive was immediately asked to answer for the apparent misplacement of billions in COVID funds after she left an afternoon meeting with the House Speaker and Senate President. This is something that we've become aware of very, very recently, Healey said alongside Speaker Ron Mariano and Senator President Karen Spilka. According to Healey, while it is clear that during the pandemic there were federal funds coming into the state from various pots following the passage of several different pandemic response bills, it is not clear how money was drawn from the wrong account or when it will need to be returned. What happened is that there were multiple funds set up, as you know, during this COVID pandemic time, and for whatever reason, money was drawn from a federal pot instead of a state pot, she said. Our plan has been to continue discussion with the U.S. Department of Labor on this and to hopefully be able to resolve things in a way that minimizes any impact to the Commonwealth. We're sort of in a fact-finding stage right now, Spilka chimed in. I think it's too early to speculate what action we would be taking. We don't even know how much we owe, Mariano added. The audit showed that in 2020 and through the pandemic, the state labor department withdrew federal relief funds for unemployment claims that should have been covered by the state's unemployment trust fund, which Massachusetts employers pay into, according to labor officials. In broad strokes, it was money that was really set aside as a federal account, a federal bucket, and we had a state bucket. At some point, these two got merged, and money was unfortunately drawn down from this federal account, Healey said. A U.S. Department of Labor spokesperson confirmed that they have been in discussion with state officials about the oversight and are working with the state on options to rectify the situation. Next, we have another article. This one's an oceanography article. It comes out of the boating section of the newspaper. NOAA offers whale watching tips. After humpback whales put on a show close to the shore in Plymouth last summer, including a high-profile incident when a whale breached onto a boat, NOAA has issued tips to help people safely operate their vessels around whales this year. Large whales can be a safety hazard for recreational boaters and fishermen because they can surface unexpectedly and are hard to detect in certain weather conditions. As whales feed at the surface and close to shore, the chances of encountering one increases, NOAA wrote on its website. Accidental collisions with these large animals can be dangerous for everyone involved and can result in costly repairs to your boat. Officials are emphasizing the See a Spout, Watch Out boater education program to keep safe when operating a vessel in waters shared by whales. Did you see a spout, a tail, or a breaching whale? Slow down and post a lookout, NOAA wrote. Some whales dive 20 minutes or more. Seeing one whale at the surface means more could be nearby. Proceed cautiously. Some whales, such as the humpback whales, create bubble clouds and bubble nets to corral schools of small fish. Never approach or drive through bubbles, NOAA warns. A feeding whale is likely to surface in that space. Also, if a whale moves away from your boat, don't chase it. Respect the whale's behavior and keep your distance. Whales are protected under federal law, so interrupting their natural behaviors is illegal, NOAA wrote. Stay parallel to the whale's course and direction while staying at least 100 feet to avoid cutting off its path or getting too close. Give North Atlantic right whales more space. It is illegal to approach within 1,500 feet or 500 yards, 5 football field lengths in U.S. waters. Meanwhile, on Tuesday, a New England aquarium scientist will testify before a congressional subcommittee on enhanced federal regulations to protect North Atlantic right whales. Jessica Redfern will be testifying in favor of proposed changes that would slow vessels to protect the critically endangered species, which has an estimated population of less than 350 individuals. Next up, we have an article, a short article again. This one's coming from the section of drone studies. Cue the Jaws theme music. Great white sharks lurked near swimmers, surfers 97% of the time. As great white sharks make their way back north to Cape Cod for the summer and fall, shark researchers have released shocking results from a 2-year drone study, showing that apex predators came very close to people, but simply moved around them or ignored them completely. The study along Southern California beaches looked at how close juvenile white sharks get to humans, such as waders, swimmers, surfers, and stand-up paddleboarders. The researchers from Cal State Long Beach Shark Lab revealed that at juvenile white shark aggregation sites, people were near sharks on 97% of the days surveyed. And during the 2-year drone study, there were no reported shark bites in any of the surveyed locations. Frankly, we were shocked, Christopher Lowe, professor of marine biology and director of CSULB Shark Lab, told the Herald on Monday. Sharks would interact with people every single day, multiple times a day, and they would just swim by. It was shocking that these occurrences were happening so often, Lowe added. And the fact that no one was being bitten smacks in the face of the misconception that if there's a white shark nearby, you'll be attacked. This shows that's not the case. More than 1,500 drone surveys were conducted from 2019 through 2021 across 26 different Southern California beaches to measure human juvenile white shark habitat overlap. The juvenile white sharks were often spotted within 50 yards of where the waves break, putting surfers and stand-up paddleboarders in the closest proximity to sharks. Some sharks were seen as close as 2 yards from the wave break. There was a number of times when white sharks would swim by people, and the people just didn't know it, Lowe said. The surfers and swimmers could not see them, and it happens far more than people imagine. Lowe grew up on Martha's Vineyard. When it was very rare to see a great white shark and when the gray seal population had not exploded along the Cape. He compared the California shark situation to the Cape shark situation, noting that researchers have been starting to see more and more sharks popping up along Southern California beaches in the last 20 years. One major difference is Cape seals have claimed territory at beaches, bringing adult white sharks closer to people. That makes a very different situation, but there's still people going in the water, and white sharks are still swimming by people on the Cape, and they aren't being bitten, Lowe said. There are a lot of opportunities to use drones along the Cape, and I think people would be surprised with what they see, he added. This method of surveillance using drone videography, can also be used for future approaches for research, education, or overall beach safety purposes. These findings are applicable on a global scale, providing confirmation of sharks and humans peacefully coinciding in the same location. I hope the state of Massachusetts does what California does and invests more in research, Lowe said. I think that will really help. We have about 2 minutes left before our break, so I'll do something we don't normally do here. I will read the forecast. If I have time, I'll read the Almanac, Sun and Moon. And if I have even more time, I will read the Lotto winning numbers drawn Monday. So for the weather today, the low forecast from AccuWeather.com. Today is a high of 74 and a low of 54. It is warmer afternoon showers. Tomorrow is a high of 66 with a low of 50, a brief shower or two. Thursday has a high of 65, a low of 50, mostly cloudy, a shower or two. And Friday has a high of 66, a low of 50, and an afternoon thunder shower. The almanac temperature, the high low is 62 to and 50. The normal high low is 74 and 56. Precipitation, 24-hour total, is 0.35 inches. Month-to-date, 0.77 inches. Year-to-date, 18.76 inches. Normal year-to-date, 21.31 inches. The sun and moon, sunrise today, 5:08 a.m. Sunset tonight, 8:20 p.m. Moonrise today, 11:32 p.m. Moonset today, 7:10 a.m. Your lotto winning numbers drawn Monday. Massachusetts midday, 6, 2, 7, 3. Payoffs on $1 bet. Exact order. All four, $4,908. First, last three, $687. Any two, $59. Any one, $6. Any four, any order. All four, $204. First three, $114. Last three, $114. Evening numbers, 4, 7, 7, 9. Payoffs on $1 bet. Exact order. All four, $5,258. First, last three, $736. Any two, $63. Any one, $6. Any order, all four, $438. First three, $245. Last three, $245. Mass cash Sunday. Your numbers would be 4, 10, 17, 26, 28. Lucky for life Sunday. Your numbers would be 13, 15, 20, 35, 41, and in parentheses 2. New Hampshire Tri-State Daily. Afternoon. Pick 3. Your numbers are 4, 9, 6. Pick 4. Your numbers are 8, 5, 0, 6. Evening. Pick 3. Your numbers are 1, 5, 2. Pick 4. Your numbers are 0, 9, 4, 0. Give me 5. Your numbers are 2, 7, 12, 37, 38. Due to our earlier deadlines, some numbers are reported a day later as noted. For more immediate results, visit www.masslottery.com and www.nhlottery.com. That is going to do it for us for now. We will take a short break and be back between 11:15 and 11:30. As a reminder, you are listening to Lowell Association for the Blind's Lab Radio. Stay tuned. We'll be back soon.
This unit is ready to join. He spoke on the condition of anonymity because he was not authorized to provide details. A unit near his pushed ahead yesterday, he said, and destroyed 8 Russian tanks. But now he said Ukraine is focused on reconnaissance operations, but the pace will increase every day. The armed forces of Ukraine are now shaking the enemy's defenses along the entire front, conducting combat reconnaissance, looking for weak points, the officer said. At the same time, rocket artillery units are destroying warehouses, Russian military command bodies, and logistics chains. At least one brigade in the southern Donetsk region is launching an offensive operation, according to a military official in the region who spoke on the condition of anonymity. The units conducting offensive operations near Bakhmut and in southern Donetsk on Monday were not among the specialized brigades, some recently trained by NATO, that are expected to lead the counteroffensive as the so-called tip of the spear. Some U.S. officials believe the counteroffensive is underway and going well for Ukraine. They point to the territorial gains made by Ukrainian forces north and south of Bakhmut and strikes deep behind Russian lines. U.S. officials caution that a successful offensive might look very different from traditional conventional operations, in which armored columns fight to penetrate enemy ground. It could involve instead what U.S. officials call modern maneuver warfare, which includes expanded artillery fire, probing attacks, and sabotage or partisan activity behind enemy lines. They hope such actions, enabled by NATO training and armed supplies, will pressure Russian troops to make mistakes and provide Ukrainian forces opportunities to advance. When asked at the White House whether the counteroffensive has begun, National Security Council spokesman John Kirby said he would not be speaking for the Ukrainian military. They're conducting some offensive operations, he said. That's for them to speak to. The Washington-based Institute for the Study of War wrote that Russian and Ukrainian officials were signaling that it had begun. The think tank said it has observed increased combat activity in different sectors of the front line and assesses that Ukrainian forces are making territorial gains despite Russian claims to the contrary. Michael Kaufman, a Russian military analyst at the Washington-based Center for New American Security, said the activity in the past day or so is probably the early phase of a Ukrainian offensive operation, but it does not appear to be the main effort. The offensive is expected to unfold over the course of months, not days. But the latest operations, Kaufman said, are a significant change in the fighting compared to what we've seen over the past month. Shuravatyi, the Eastern Command spokesman, denied that the counteroffensive has started. In reality, when this starts, everyone will know about it, he told the Post. He said the operation would hinge on an element of surprise, like the lightning strike last fall that pushed Russian forces out of positions in the northeast Kharkiv region. It will be like Kharkiv, Shuravatyi said, fast, effective, and obvious to them and everyone else. Before the push through Kharkiv last September, Ukraine maneuvered its forces to suggest preparations for an attack in the Kherson region to the south. Kyiv later admitted that it was an intentional diversion. A counterattack in Kherson then followed in November. The position of the state is to not admit the counteroffensive and not to tie it to a specific date, Interior Ministry Advisor Anton Goroshenko told the Post, because if it does that, it will demotivate people and will be a source of manipulation. So therefore, it is ongoing. Ukraine's military on Sunday released a video of soldiers putting fingers to the lips, remaining silent. Shh, the Defense Ministry tweeted Monday. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky thanked troops around Bakhmut for their advances against Russian forces. I am grateful to each of our soldiers, all of our defenders, who on this day gave us exactly the news we expect. Those in Bakhmut direction, well done, soldiers, Zelensky said Monday in his nightly address, posted on Telegram. Ukrainian advances followed attacks by anti-Russian forces against at least 10 villages in Russia's Belgorod region earlier Monday, its governor said, an escalation in cross-border fighting. Belgorod Governor Vyacheslav Gladkov blamed the attacks on Ukraine's military, but two anti-Putin paramilitary groups claimed credit for them. The fighting appeared to intensify Monday as a power facility caught fire following a drone attack. The Russian town of Shevchenko, located about 4 miles from the Ukrainian border, also came under heavy shelling, residents told Radio Free Europe. The pro-Ukrainian militias, which claim to have carried out a series of cross-border incursions in recent days, said their forces mounted another attack on government facilities and took Russian soldiers prisoner over the weekend. Gladkov said Sunday that he was willing to meet an opposition group that had taken prisoners from the region, but the governor skipped the meeting, according to the Russian Volunteer Corps, one of two anti-Kremlin militia groups operating on Russian soil in support of Ukraine. Kiev has denied any involvement in the attacks on Russian soil and sought to distance it from the groups. But in a jab at Moscow, Ukrainian military intelligence spokesman Andrei Yusov told Ukrainian national television on Saturday that Russia was unable to quash the paramilitary attacks because its security forces were trained only to beat the participants of peaceful protests. Ilya Ponomarev, a founder of the Free Russia Legion, the second militia group, claimed that anti-Putin forces now control about a dozen settlements in Belgorod region. Ponomarev said the Free Russia Legion is operating in Shevchenko. Russian authorities have said the town is being hit by Ukrainian armed forces from across the border. The Russian Defense Ministry said Monday its forces had stopped an attempt by Ukrainian terrorists on Sunday to enter Novaya Tavlshanka via the nearby Savinsky Donets River, which crosses into Russia from Ukraine. The ministry said Russia had 10 of the attackers. But Russian authorities could not enter Novaya Tavlshanka, Gladkov said Monday night on social media. That appeared to confirm claims by the militias that they were in control of the settlement and that Russia's border security measures were insufficient for the second time in 2 weeks. The Russian ranks appeared to be in disarray once again. Some pro-Russian bloggers dubbed the area the Belgorod front line, underscoring the blowback of Moscow's stalling invasion of Ukraine with active fighting underway on Russian soil. At least 4,000 people, roughly 10% of Shevchenko's population, have evacuated in recent days. Many are now housed in shelters in the regional capital of Belgorod City, Gladkov said. At least 10 people died and dozens have been hospitalized with blast injuries in the past week, local media reported. In Belgorod and two other border regions, local radio stations broadcast a fake announcement from Russian President Vlad Putin, who urged listeners to evacuate deeper into the country immediately and announced a general mobilization to defeat the cunning and dangerous enemy. The purpose of the message is to sow panic among peaceful Belgorod residents, local authorities said. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov said Monday that the radio stations were hacked. The broadcasters had since regained control. In another bizarre turn, the months-long feud between Wagner mercenary boss Yevgeny Prigozhin and Russia's defense ministry appeared to have moved beyond rhetoric. Prigozhin accused the regular military of placing explosives on roads used by the mercenaries to retreat from Bakhmut. Russia recently captured the eastern Ukrainian city after a months-long siege led by Wagner. On Sunday, Prigozhin posted a statement saying that Russian soldiers shelled his fighters as they demined the roads. He claimed the alleged attack was repelled, and Wagner detained Lieutenant Colonel Roman Venevitin of Russia's 72nd Motorized Rifle Brigade. Shortly after, Prigozhin's press service posted a video showing what happened, or rather what appeared to be, Venevitin confessing that he had ordered his troops to shoot at Wagner mercenaries in a state of intoxication and out of personal enmity. Prigozhin's claims could not be independently verified, and the Russian Defense Ministry did not publicly comment on the accusations. Moving to our second story from the front page, Trump's lawyers ask Justice Department not to charge Trump in classified docs case. High-stakes meeting included special counsel Jack Smith, who is leading probe of Trump's conduct and possible obstruction. This piece is by Jacqueline Alamany, Spencer Yu, and Devlin Barrett, and also Josh Dossi. Attorneys for Don Trump went to the Justice Department on Monday morning to make their case that the government should not charge the former president in connection with his possession of classified documents after leaving office, according to people familiar with the matter. Trump lawyers Lindsay Halligan, John Rowley, and James Trustee spent about 2 hours at the Justice Department and left without speaking to reporters. They met with Justice Department personnel, including Special Counsel Jack Smith and a senior career official, but not Attorney General Merrick Garland or Deputy Attorney General Lisa Monaco, said people familiar with the matter, who, like others interviewed for this article, spoke on the condition of anonymity to discuss a closed-door proceeding. The Justice Department has declined to comment. Well, it is not uncommon in high-profile cases for defense lawyers to get such a meeting with Justice Department officials toward the end of an investigation. And former officials say such presentations rarely change prosecutors' minds. Two Trump advisors briefed on Monday's meeting said they continue to believe Smith will finalize a charging decision in coming weeks. The advisors said they are preparing for a potential indictment of the former president, and the meeting did not change their expectations. A CBS News camera crew first spotted the Trump lawyers walking into the building. In late May, Rowley and Trustee sent a letter to Garland asking for a meeting to discuss what they call the unfair treatment of Trump, by Smith, who is leading the probe. Then Halligan, along with Timothy Parlatore, an attorney who has since left Trump's legal team, sent a much more detailed letter to members of Congress in late April saying the classified documents case should be investigated administratively, not as a criminal matter. Smith was appointed to lead the case in November after Trump launched his 2024 bid for president. His team of federal prosecutors is investigating whether Trump or those close to him mishandled classified documents the former president kept after leaving office, or obstructed government efforts to retrieve them. As special counsel, Smith has greater autonomy than other prosecutors in the Justice Department. Under department regulations, the Attorney General may overrule the special counsel only if the special counsel has failed to follow Justice Department policies and practices. Federal grand jury in D.C. has heard testimony from dozens of witnesses in recent months. Investigators also have surveillance video showing boxes of documents being moved at Mar-a-Lago, Trump's Florida residence and private club, and an audio recording of Trump talking about having an apparently classified document in his possession. In addition, testimony from at least one witness related to the documents probe has also been sought by Smith's investigators before a federal grand jury in southern Florida, a jurisdiction that includes Mar-a-Lago, a person familiar with the investigation said. Grand jury proceedings are secret, Prosecutors in general will not discuss an investigation while it is still ongoing. The classified documents case is one of four criminal probes involving the former president. Smith is separately investigating the conduct of Trump in his inner circle in connection to efforts to block results of the 2020 presidential election. The district attorney in Fulton County, Georgia, is doing the same. And Trump has been indicted in New York on charges of falsifying business records connected to hush money payments during the 2016 election. Trump has denied wrongdoing in each case. After Monday's meeting ended, Trump posted on social media, in all caps, "How can DOJ possibly charge me? Who did nothing wrong? When no other presidents were charged? The greatest witch hunt of all time." End quote. In the April letter to U.S. lawmakers, Trump's lawyers laid out their argument for why Trump should not be charged. They said the White House practices for handling classified information across multiple administrations differ so much from how other parts of the government handle national secrets, and as a result, the Mar-a-Lago case should be handled as a civil matter, not a criminal one, they said. The letter also said that Trump's departure from the White House was rushed, and that there was not sufficient opportunity to separate out papers that should not have been kept. The examination of Trump's retention of classified documents after leaving the White House dates back more than 2 years. It began with the National Archives and Records Administration, which spent months asking Trump to return what it suspected were presidential records, historical documents that are government property, and that were not transferred to the archives when Trump's term ended. 15 boxes of papers from Mar-a-Lago were sent to the archives in early 2022. When archives officials opened the boxes, they found more than 100 classified documents scattered among the various items. That led to questions about whether Trump had more classified papers at his Florida home. Trump's legal team handed over another 38 documents last June in response to a grand jury subpoena. But an FBI search of Mar-a-Lago 2 months later turned up more than 100 additional documents and items marked classified, even though the subpoena had demanded the return of any such material. In recent weeks, Smith's team has asked archives officials to finish gathering and sending over a separate tranche of government documents that were the subject of a different subpoena. That subpoena to the archives sought documents regarding the Trump administration's classification and declassification practices, according to a person familiar with the request, who also spoke on the condition of anonymity to discuss it. The request included classification training logs, any materials related to safeguarding sensitive documents in the Trump White House, decisions made regarding classification policy, and more, the person added. The archives has already turned over thousands of documents to the Justice Department, the person said, and is continuing to produce them on a rolling basis as quickly as possible. Okay, still on the front page, let's move to the third article in today's reading, one of the top stories in the news of late. Flyby found plane's pilot slumped over. F-16 flyer sent to intercept plane saw pilot slumped over before crash. Experts said flight data suggests that the pilot was unconscious and that the plane was on autopilot until it ran out of fuel. This piece is by Ian Duncan, Dan Lamouth, Emily Davies, Michael Laris, and Lori Aratani. The pilot of a military jet that was scrambled to intercept a private plane that flew over D.C. before crashing in rural Virginia saw that aircraft's pilot slumped over, according to two people familiar with the situation. The development, described by people speaking on the condition of anonymity because of the ongoing investigation, came as National Transportation Safety Board investigators on Monday arrived at the scene of a private jet crash, which was linked to a sonic boom heard a day earlier across Washington across the Washington region as F-16s flew to intercept the aircraft. Adam Gerhardt, the lead investigator, said that he expects his team to be on the scene for 3 or 4 days and that investigators will deal or will be dealing with remote mountainous terrain. The wreckage is highly fragmented, Gerhardt said yesterday near the scene. Experts said publicly available data suggests that the pilot had fallen unconscious, probably because of loss of pressurization, and that the plane was on autopilot until it ran out of fuel. The Federal Aviation Administration said preliminary information shows the pilot and all three passengers died, which it said occurred under unknown circumstances. The plane that crashed was registered to Encore Motors of Melbourne, a Florida-based company owned by John Rumpel. He said the plane departed Elizabethton, Tennessee, to carry his daughter, Adina Azarian, his 2.5-year-old granddaughter, Aria, and their nanny to their home in East Hampton, New York. Rumpel identified the pilot as Jeff Hefner, who he said had been flying his planes on and off for more than 5 years. The nanny's name was not available Monday. FAA records show Hefner was an experienced pilot with a rating that qualified him to fly Boeing 737s, among other jets. He had a top-level medical certificate as recently as October. Rumpel said authorities told him the plane might have crashed after losing pressure, which could have caused those inside to lose consciousness. The Cessna Citation departed Sunday from Tennessee and was bound for Long Island, but it turned back south after reaching New York and eventually flew over D.C. The NTSB said contact with the plane was lost during its ascent at about 31,000 feet, about 15 minutes after departure, as it was passing over Virginia the first time. The two people familiar with the investigation said the pilot of a military jet saw the Citation's pilot sitting in the left seat and slumped toward the right. The plane continued to fly at about 34,000 feet, overflying Long Island MacArthur Airport, until it began to descend at 3:23 p.m., spiraling to the ground and crashing 9 minutes later. 6 F-16s were scrambled from Joint Base Andrews in Maryland and 2 other facilities, a Pentagon spokesman said. The F-16s were granted rare authorization by commanders to fly at supersonic speeds over an urban area for the intercept, causing the boom and indicating the urgency of the military's response. It is important for the responding aircraft, in this case F-16s, to reach the situation as quickly as possible, said Lieutenant Colonel Devin Robinson, a Pentagon spokesman. This allows more time for the people on the ground to run through procedures and gives more time for decisions to be made. The military jets and air traffic controllers were unable to make contact with the plane, officials said, and it crashed about 3:30 p.m. in Augusta County, more than a mile from the Blue Ridge Parkway. Virginia State Police said remains recovered at the scene will be taken to the Office of Virginia Medical Examiner for examination and positive identification. First responders reached the crash site about 8 p.m. Sunday, police said, and investigators hiked through the heavily wooded terrain. The wreckage will be moved to a facility in Delaware. National Security Council spokesman John Kirby told reporters Monday that officials were on the phone and receiving real-time updates from the F-16 pilots and that President Biden was kept informed. They did exactly what they were supposed to do, Kirby said of the military pilots. Try to get on the radio, communicate to the pilot that wasn't working, made themselves visible. That didn't work, and tragically it ended, obviously, in the crash and death of all on board. Recordings of radio communications included attempts by several aircraft and the FAA to reach the plane. Among those making attempts were pilots from an American Airlines flight, according to people familiar with the transmissions who were not authorized to speak publicly. NTSB investigators will document the crash scene and examine the wreckage, as well as gather information from radar, weather data, the plane's maintenance records, in pilot medical records. The board is expected to release a preliminary report in about 3 weeks, summarizing facts that investigators have gathered. The final report, including a formal cause, will probably take at least a year. The plane made no attempt to descend on Long Island and appeared to have turned around to head back to Tennessee. Hassan Shahidi, president and CEO of the nonprofit Flight Safety Foundation, said the route was perplexing and will be a focus for investigators. He said it would not be normal for a plane to set out for a destination, then make a U-turn and head toward where it started, even if autopilot capabilities were guiding the plane. It's very unclear why it made this maneuver so close to its intended destination, Shahidi said. The aircraft, especially the Cessna airplane, it has to be directed by the pilot to take a certain flight path and altitude. Investigators will try to scrutinize all the different maneuvering instructions the aircraft received during its flight from pilot or autopilot, including how high to fly and in which direction, he said. They will then compare those details with the timing of air traffic control communications and when the pilot stopped responding. Jeff Guzzetti, a former FAA and NTSB investigator, said flight tracking data suggests that long before the plane reached New York, the pilot was not in control. Whatever happened, happened at altitude, which is a critical location to lose pressurization, Guzzetti said. The higher up in altitude you are, the less time you have to get on oxygen. The plane continued to fly at about 34,000 feet until it began to spiral toward the ground. Guzzetti said the final minutes of the flight indicated fuel for the plane's right engine was exhausted. It will be up to the NTSB to determine what might have caused the plane to lose pressure and why the pilot was not able to use an oxygen system. Guzzetti said investigators will want to know when the oxygen system was last serviced and whether maintenance records reveal any issues with the plane. It's going to be challenging for the NTSB to answer these questions given the destruction of the wreckage, he said. A spokesman for the North American Aerospace Defense Command said two jets inspected the Cessna, which was intercepted about 3:20 p.m. The pilot was unresponsive and the plane crashed near the George Washington National Forest in Virginia, officials said. The military did not shoot down the plane, and there was no indication the interception caused the crash. The crash location is about 160 miles southwest of Washington. Records from the FAA indicate the plane was only recently acquired by Encore. Guzzetti said that transaction would have involved an inspection of the registration and ownership records by the FAA, but only a cursory one that probably would not have delved into the condition of the plane's pressurization system. The sonic boom heard from Springfield, Virginia to Bowie, Maryland, according to social media reports, startled residents in the Washington region Sunday afternoon. The source of the sound was a mystery for about an hour until local authorities confirmed that it had been caused by fighter jets. The six F-16s were scrambled simultaneously in response to the situation and included two with the 113th Fighter Wing from the D.C. Air National Guard reaching the Cessna first after departing from Joint Base Andrews in Maryland. The other jets were with the New Jersey Air National Guard's 117th Fighter Wing flying from Atlantic City in the South Carolina Air National Guard's fighter wing responding from McIntyre Joint National Guard Base, Robinson said. Robinson said the intercept occurred about 20 miles northeast of Reagan International Airport. It was not clear Monday where the military plane crossed the sound barrier, a phenomenon that creates an air pressure change resulting in a deep boom. The military often conducts intercepts of unidentified objects or aircraft that are not making customary check-ins with controllers on the ground. But it is unusual for commanders to authorize supersonic speed over an urban area. Other recent intercepts by the U.S. military include scrambles earlier this year to reach unidentified objects flying over the United States after an alleged Chinese surveillance airship made a cross-country flight beginning over Alaska and concluding with it being shot down by F-22s off South Carolina. Other objects were intercepted over Alaska and over the Midwest, one shot down over Lake Huron. Aviation industry experts, without reaching conclusions on the plane's cause, on Monday pointed to the 1999 death of professional golfer Payne Stewart and five others after their business jet flew for hours without a pilot controlling the aircraft. F-16 pilots who had scrambled to monitor the Learjet eventually watched as it dropped toward Aberdeen, South Dakota. Investigators from the NTSB concluded the pilots became incapacitated because they didn't receive supplemental oxygen after the cabin lost pressure. But in a sign of the complexities of such probes, investigators weren't able to determine why the pilots couldn't get the oxygen quickly enough. Scott Wagner, an assistant professor in the Department of Aeronautical Science at Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University, said incidents involving the loss of pressurization on an aircraft are uncommon. A high-profile instance occurred in 2018 after a Dallas-bound Southwest Airlines flight was forced to make an emergency landing at Philadelphia International Airport after one of its engines exploded and debris shattered a window.
Good morning. We are back. You are listening to Lowell Association for the Blind's Lab Radio. Lab Radio is a member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. Lab would like to thank UMass Lowell's WUML-FM for providing the radio signal that allows us to broadcast 5 days a week. Excuse me. Jumping back into things, I would like to go to another article under the graduation section of today's newspaper. Neshoba Tech celebrates the class of 2023. Westford. Neshoba Valley Technical High School's class of 2023 celebrated their graduation on Saturday, June 3rd. Congratulations to all of the graduates, listed here alphabetically by town. Acton. Sylvia Dominguez Bodie. Ashby, Jonathan Dow. Air, Benjamin Andrews. Ellie Barnowski. Samuel Barr. Andrew Bozek. Nicholas Cambridge. Caden Dunn. Laura DuPont. Shaylin Finlay. Mariah Gundoff, Max Kuagu, Anthony Kutsoufis, Ashley Metcalf, Kiara Musel, Benjamin Pepin, Esperanza Ray, Hans Dietrich Eschuletter, Lillian Woodward, Billerica, Peter Blydell, Kaylee Pearson, Boxborough, Caleb Sperling, Chelmsford, Juliana Abel, Caden Adams, Cassidy Allen, Elizabeth Barron, Aiden Boxer, Dylan Brzowski, Rory Cannon, Ethan Carpenter, Julia Carr, Julia Chamberlain, Carly Cogliano, Justin Curtis, Rachel Davidson, Anthony DeBenedictis, Colette DeFresne, John Dugan, Michelle Dunn, Charles Ellis, Maya Fifield, Archer Fitzgerald, Jacob Jennau, Adam Gentuso, Charlie Graney, David Green, Logan Green, Andrew Hewitt, Landon Hill, Thomas German, John Kenny, Chelsea Lyle, Christopher Manieri, Haley Mann, Dylan Martin Rogue, Harrison Mayoide, Austin Molinari, Jennifer Montero, Nicholas Moore, Elise Nardon, Hannah Ossoff, James Paul, Matthew Piccolotto, Joshua Rasposa, Dylan Schenk, Emily Skinner, Paul St. Amand, Ben Stilwell, Evan Stripp, James Talbot, Dylan Withrow, Chelsea, Jaden Barnett, Drakett, Lillian Estevao, Harrison Gendron, Dunstable, Connor Buchanan, Emily Callahan, Fitchburg, Janelle Soto, Groton, Haley Barden, Evan Moskrop, James Partridge, Haverhill, Justin Ryan, Lemonster, Emma Murphy, Littleton, Eden Howard, Brandon Lavoie, Andrew Lelievre, Vanessa Newbold, Sophia O'Donohue, Dominic Philbrick, Lowell, Joanna D'Souza, Peyton Ledebouche, Taylor Logan, Lunenberg, Ella Hall, Pepperell, Savannah Albert, Molly Allen, Ashley Bubian, Nathan Blaisdell, Cody Buckley, Stephen Camire, Matthew DeCiso, Jenna Drum, Alyssa Felix, Sean Flitter, Brianna Hall, Angela Hoffman, Bethany Lampron, Ian McDermott, Zachary McKenna, Anthony Montesanti, Alexis Moulton, Megan Nicholson, Jonathan Ortiz. Ivor Parsons. Christopher Powers. Augustine Sears. James Young. Catherine Young. Rutland. Demetria Pedigo. Shirley. Aiden Koss. Nicholas Coulter. Alexander Gendron. Zoe Holston. Jeffrey Moon. Abigail Peckham. Benjamin Rand. Alexis Richard. Sophia Spagnolia. Townsend. Jordan Andre. Riley Berry. Matthew Blaisdell. Daniel Carbone. Richard Cheekyoin. Cameron Connell. Jonathan Coulter. Trevor Desjardins. Tyler Hembro. Louis Lavigier. Isabella Leonardo. Declan Lopez. Sammy Mustafa. Haley Martag. Elizabeth Path. Skylar Riccardi. Tingsboro. Chantal Beltran. Jaden Volkovich. Westford. Jonathan Allen. Anas Altuwaiti. Stephanie Battle. Dylan Burns. Hunter Concession. Ivan Kripanuk. Matthew Gillen. Thomas Gittner. Kyle Gerard. Chloe Greensdale. Caitlin Landers. Zachary MacDonald. Thomas Nielsen. Dallas Quakensbush. Jackson Smith. Daniel Stone. Riley Tigg. And you'll have to excuse me, folks, if I pronounce those names wrong. I'm so sorry if I butchered any of those names to the graduates or their families. The paper did not list phonetic spelling, so I am sorry if I struggled on some of those names. Regardless, everyone who graduated, that is a very, very milestone, a big milestone, and an important accomplishment, and I wish you all the best on your future endeavors. Next up, we have the 5-minute read. Opening day of Tewksbury Community Market. Tewksbury. Bring an appetite for food and adventure to the opening day of the Tewksbury Community Market on Thursday, June 15th, 4 to 7 p.m. in the parking lot behind the Recreation Center at 288 Livingston Street. The market runs every Thursday until September 28th. More than 30 vendors will be on hand offering farm-fresh vegetables, fresh-baked desserts, cold-pressed juices, as well as other food choices such as mac and cheese, seafood, and barbecue. We browse the creations made by local artisans and crafters. Food trucks serving roast beef sandwiches and empanadas will also be on site. Most vendors accept both cash and credit. For information, visit TewksburyMarket.com or call 978-640-4490, exit 205. Have a question about the market? Contact community/economic development planner Alex Loader at 978-640-4370, extension 248, or alouder@tewksburyma.gov, and community outreach librarian Robert Hayes at 978-640-4490, exit 205, or rhayes@tewksburypl.org. Memory Care Community Recognized. Chelmsford. The atrium at Drum Hill, a benchmark land and memory care community located at 2 Technology Drive, earned best status in U.S. News and World Report's second annual Best Senior Living Ratings, published in May. Drum Hill was ranked among the best memory care communities in Massachusetts and the entire U.S. for the second straight year following a comprehensive resident and family member survey. The atrium is the only dedicated memory care community in the greater Lowell area to have earned this prestigious award. We are honored and humbled that our residents and their families once again recognize the hard work, compassion, and dedication of our 6,000 plus associates. It's their shared purpose of transforming lives through human connection that earned Benchmark these U.S. News and World Report awards and continues to separate Benchmark communities from other senior living companies, Chairman and CEO of Benchmark Tom Grape said. Film Festival, Chelmsford. Chelmsford Telemedia announces its third annual film festival on Friday, June 9th, 7:30 p.m. at the Chelmsford Center for the Arts, LA North Road. Tickets are $10 at the door with a cash bar. Few high school student films representing the communities of Chelmsford, Billerica, Acton, Lowell, and Tingsboro. Films vary in genre and length. For information, call 978-250-3780 or email cca@chelmsfordma.gov. Diaper Drive, Lowell. On Saturday, June 10th, from 10 a.m. to noon, State Rep. Vanna Howard is holding her second annual diaper drive to benefit the Wish Project at Colley Stadium, 424 Douglas Road. All sizes and brands of diapers and wipes are accepted, although the greatest need is for diapers sizes 4, 5, and 6. For more information, call 978-272-9078 or visit the wishproject.org. Rivers Month with NRWA. Groton. Celebrate the National River during Rivers Month on Sunday, June 11th from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. at the Petapawag Boat Launch, Nod Road. Activities include paddling a canoe, live music, and the cardboard canoe races. Stop by the National River Watershed Association table to say hello. This free public event is sponsored by the Groton Greenway Committee. For information, call 978-448-0299 or email nrwa@nationalriverwatershed.org. This news comes from The Nation. It is a short article as we're wrapping things up here for today. Three killed in Iowa building collapse. Lawsuits say owner didn't warn residents of danger. Davenport, Iowa. The bodies of three Iowa men have been removed from the site of a collapse six-story apartment building about a week after part of the century-old structure tumbled to the ground, the city of Davenport's police chief announced Monday. We don't have any other information at this time that there are any additional people missing, Chief Jeff Bledel said. Meanwhile, residents of the building have started filing lawsuits. One, filed Monday by Dana Feuerbach, is accusing the city and the building's current and former owners of knowing of the deteriorating conditions and failing to warn residents of the risk. A second action by Mildred Harrington against the building owners alone alleges the same. Feuerbach's lawsuit alleges multiple counts of negligence, and both actions seek unspecified damages. The city had warning after warning, attorney Jeffrey Goodman, who represents Feuerbach, told the Associated Press. He called it a common trend in major structural collapses he's seen. They had the responsibility to make sure that the safety of the citizens comes first. It is very clear that the city of Davenport didn't do that. City documents released last week and cited in the lawsuit suggest concerns about the integrity of parts of the building that were conveyed to the city and owner, Andrew Wald, over the course of months. A recording of a 911 call, placed just the day before the partial collapse, reveals the director of a local organization affiliated with the Chamber of Commerce reported a contractor's concerns about a wall's integrity. City fire officials responded by visiting the site for less than 5 minutes, according to the dispatch log. The police chief said Brandon Colvin Sr.'s body was recovered Saturday. The body of Ryan Hitchcock was recovered Sunday and Daniel Prehn early Monday. City officials had said earlier that Colvin, 42, Hitchcock, 51, and Prehn, 60, had high probability of being home at the time of the collapse. The discoveries came after authorities announced that the search for survivors had been completed. The remains of the apartment building were constantly in motion in the first 24 to 36 hours after it collapsed on May 28th, putting rescuers at great risk. But since the area has been stabilized, crews were using an excavator and other heavy equipment to pull out parts of a debris pile. Davenport officials said they were consulting with experts about how to safely bring down the rest of the structure. The city fire marshal earlier said explosives would not be used because it's close to other buildings and a busy part of downtown Davenport. I have the death notices for you today, folks. Darlene M. Robitale of Lowell, 60. Judith A. LaPointe of Lowell. Her age is not listed. Marilyn J. Stevens of Dunstable. Her age is not listed. Excuse me, it says 80 years old. Elizabeth Betty Day of Dunstable, 81. Carol M. Grant of Chelmsford, 77, and John P. Bova of Billerica, age 72. May they and all the other faithfully departed rest in peace. We have one more short article before we round things out for the day. Former FBI agent Robert Hallinson, who was convicted of spying for Russia, dies in prison. Washington. Robert Hallinson, a former FBI agent who took more than $14 million in cash and diamonds to trade secrets with Moscow in one of the most notorious spying cases in American history, died in prison Monday. Hansen, 79, was found unresponsive in a cell at a federal prison in Florence, Colorado, and later pronounced dead, prison officials said. He is believed to have died of natural causes, a person familiar with the matter told the Associated Press. The person was not authorized to publicly discuss details of Hansen's death and spoke to the APN condition of anonymity. He had been serving a sentence of life in prison without possibility of parole since 2002 after pleading guilty to 15 counts of espionage and other charges. Hansen had divulged a wealth of information about American intelligence gathering, including extensive detail about how U.S. officials had tapped into Russian spy operations since at least 1985. He was believed to have been partly responsible for the deaths of at least three Soviet officers who were working for U.S. intelligence and executed after being exposed. He got more than $14 million in cash, bank funds, diamonds, and Rolex watches in exchange for providing highly classified national